You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. Our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hello.
So let's some developing news today. It looks like Boise State will play football after all this fall. Jimmy, can you kind of get us started as to this seemed to have moved fairly quickly. I mean, there was a meeting last night and it's kind of just picked up momentum since then.
Yeah, that's right. So we just heard about an hour ago that the Mountain West Conference is rescheduling 8 football games. For the member states or member schools anyway, of which Boise State is obviously one. And then it depends on whether or not the local and state regulations will allow them to play. That's a big consideration in California, especially, but here in Ada County as well, since Ada County is under stage 3 restrictions with only a certain number of people can maybe even go to Albertson Stadium, depending on social distancing rules, et cetera. And so Boise State was looking at, a multi-million dollar hit to its budget if no football was played. In a letter to the campus community, Dr. Marlene Tromp said that the school had already taken, up to $15 million dollars in hits just because we didn't have sports at the beginning of the school year. So we're still kind of waiting to see what the final fallout of that is, but at least, further financial problems are going to be lessened by this.
And I'm curious too, because we do know that, other big conferences, had said we won't play and now they will play. And the Mountain West, it seems like finally realized, well, maybe we should play too. And so now we're waiting. So then, Jimmy, if I'm understanding you right, we're just waiting to find out then who can play in the Mountain West and then when those games would potentially happen.
Right. It kind of seems like we're waiting on the scheduling portion of it. This is developing still. I'm kind of looking at KTVB sports director Jay Tuss' timeline. He's been following it pretty closely. Scheduling is still yet to be worked out. But something interesting, too, that he's reporting is that Boise State told him 2 weeks ago that it costs $30,000 a week to test, between a quarter and half of their student athletes each week. And the Mountain West has a reserve fund that's going to cover those costs. So that's also a big consideration for budgetary issues. But the top line, Boise State will play football. We don't know what it's going to look like and we don't know who they'll play. But it seems like they're going to have 8 games anyway.
Okay. Kevin, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with K-12 schools. And any of you feel free to jump in on this, because schools started back in some capacity around the state a few weeks ago. A lot of different formats, right? Some were online, some were hybrid, some were all back in school, some had mask mandates, some don't. And now we are seeing some schools closing, but also, Kevin, some really heartbreaking news coming out of Middleton.
Yes, very definitely. Wednesday night, school board meeting, we heard that an employee in the Middleton School District had died from COVID-19. It is, to my recollection, the first COVID-19 fatality involving a school or a school employee. What we've later come to learn through the Southwest Idaho Health District is that this employee did not have contact with students and apparently contracted the coronavirus outside of school and before the school year. So we have a little bit more detail about the situation in Middleton. But as you mentioned, Middleton, like school districts and charter schools across the state, are really wrestling with the question of what to do with the school year and how to navigate the school year. And, this has been a sobering week as well, as we've watched that unfold. We've had several cases in the state, several examples in the state of schools having to close or move online very abruptly. The North Star Charter School, a large charter school in Eagle, closed its elementary school and went online due to an outbreak. Emmett is in a closure today, a partial closure. Glens Ferry, a rural school district in Elmore County, is closing. And I suspect that this is what we're going to see more of as this unfolds. It's a, it's a very difficult situation, obviously, for trustees and for administrators to navigate. And as we saw, and with tragic implications in Middleton, that this is going to affect not just students, but it can affect employees and staff. And maybe one of the most sobering aspects of the Middleton story is one of the trustees said on Wednesday that maybe about a quarter of Middleton's staff is of age that they would be in a higher risk category in terms of contracting COVID-19. So, this is going to be a very serious situation and a very difficult situation going forward.
And I think staying with that, though, Scott, you recently wrote an opinion piece, because when we did find out about this staff member having passed away, and we should also know that there's an elementary school teacher in Middleton who had contracted COVID and is not doing well either, is that one of the school board members, correct, Scott, basically called this a hiccup?
Yeah. And, I don't think he was referring directly to the death of the, the staffer, but, he was talking, I hate to say, cavalierly about the situation where you do have a teacher who's in quarantine and they were just told that the teacher is not doing well. I understand school board members' position that they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, that they want to get kids in person, into in-person classes. I think when you're talking about the seriousness of this virus and the lethality of it and how contagious it is, and how easily it can spread, I think, the school board members need to be erring on the side of caution and not treating deaths and illnesses as just a hiccup, a bump in the road, we have to move forward. We've got to get kids back in class. I think they need to temper all of that with a recognition that this is a really serious virus and disease. And, a lot of this is just, it's kind of an inevitability. You can just see this coming. And we're starting to hear reports from parents and teachers and schools saying that there are mask breaks where they're letting kids take their masks off in the classroom, which is just
all at once, by the way, not just like one child all at once.
Right. And it just, that defeats the entire purpose of it. And if we're doing that and we're treating this like it's not serious and it can't be spread and kids can't spread it, and this is what we're going to run into.
And Gemma, I think it's important to note, and I think it's fair to say that Middleton is probably similar to a lot of communities in the state in that there's probably a significant constituency that is very skeptical about coronavirus. They're skeptical about the case numbers. They're skeptical about the health implications. They're skeptical about the utility of masks. How can I say that definitively? Look at the latest elections. Look at the spring primary. Tammy Nichols, representative who lives in Middleton, won re-election in the primary, won against a member of the school board in Middleton, by the way, won fairly handily. She has been one of the most outspoken COVID deniers. She has been very clear about that. I think that represents a fairly significant constituency within Middleton. And, that rhetoric and that mindset is going to run against the reality that we're seeing in the cases and in the numbers, and in this case, in the death of an employee.
And I think we need to know too that Middleton is in Canyon County, and this is where wearing a mask is only a recommendation from the Southwest District Health Board. And to my understanding, it's up to faculty and students if they want to wear a mask or not wear a mask. And, in Emmett, there is a picture on social media that went out of Emmett High School's pep rally from last Friday. All of the kids sitting close together, no masks. So it goes against everything that we know from scientists and what they are saying about social distancing and wearing masks. And with that then, Jimmy, we have at least Central District Health is going to be keeping Ada and Valley counties in their mask mandate, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. No changes there. And I guess during the meeting, they said that Ada County saw a 20% uptick in cases over the past week, which they say is partly due to Labor Day celebrations, which is what a lot of public health experts were warning us about. You know, if you do have family gatherings, keep them small, keep them outside if you can, wear a mask and socially distance yourself from your family members. And it seems like we're seeing the results of that. So they also said that they saw coronavirus cases at K-12 schools in Ada, Valley, Boise, and Elmore counties, but they're not releasing that information, claiming that they can't under federal privacy laws. Restrictions on businesses are going to continue to... The only timeline that they put out there this week was that they might lift the mask mandate in Valley County in the first part of October, which I guess is coming up next week.
But Jimmy, can they actually release these numbers about the outbreaks in schools, or not even outbreaks? How about just like there's a case, right?
So it depends on who you talk to, with most things in the legal realm. But as you know, a pretty strong supporter of the First Amendment over here, I would say that no, they can't. But that's not me. I'm not a lawyer, and that is not a legal opinion. So we will see how this unfolds coming.
So go ahead, Kevin.
And let's kind of watch what the Department of Health and Welfare does in the upcoming weeks. They're talking about trying to set up a database to try to release some of the school level data, because what we're seeing, this is a mess. Some school districts are being very upfront and trying very hard to get data out. Boise School District is a good example of that. West Ada, with 40,000 students, is being very, very tight-lipped about coronavirus case information. And shout out, Scott, to your colleagues at the Statesman, who did a really good reporting on this a few days ago about the inconsistencies in terms of what is being released by the school district. So we'll wait and see what happens with health and welfare. Health and welfare has done a really good job in the past in terms of releasing detailed data about vaccinations in the schools. So I'm hopeful that health and welfare is at least going to try to do this in the spirit of openness, because their track record on that front has been pretty good. But my goodness, 40,000 students and you can't release information, and you're saying that the failure or the inability to release data is because you're concerned about student privacy. You can release data in a data set that large without identifying students. Colleges and universities are doing it. I can't see how West Ada can say that they can't.
And let me add to that, Kevin, that you know, because they can release that information without identifying people, by not releasing that information, I'm no lawyer either, but they're breaking the law. That is not in holding with the public records law of Idaho, and it's not in keeping with the HIPAA laws that they continue to cite. And Mike Licklama has indeed done a great job. And he's run into troubles with the West Ada School District in the past with their openness, or I should say lack of openness. This would be a really good opportunity for that district to hit the reset button and start being open with the public and release this information and do the right thing here and follow the law.
And I am really struck by the differences between what we're seeing with the K-12 and with higher education. I'm going to launch a weekly story, a roundup of what's happening with the coronavirus case numbers on campuses, because all 11 colleges and universities in the state, public and private, large and small, are releasing data in some degree. I mean, they're, you know, all of the sites are a little bit different. All of the information comes out at different times. It's going to be a little bit wonky to put it all together. But at least they're putting information out, not just for us, but for students and for parents, so that they know what they're up against. And that's really what this comes down to with K-12. It's not about making life easier for Kevin Richard as a reporter or for the Idaho Statesman as an institution. It's about getting the information in front of parents so that they can make informed decisions about what to do with their kids. That's the bottom line here.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that if you look at the Boise School District, they were releasing cases when everyone was fully online, saying that in this school there was this case. Well, we know that those, whether they, and we don't know if they were students or they were staff, we know they weren't getting it at school because they weren't in school. They were still releasing.
But it sets a good precedent as they start to bring kids back into the schools. It sets a good, it's a good start. And I expect that they'll continue along that path.
Right. Well, and as parents, you want and you need all of that information, as you said. Before we move on to some other topics, Kevin, I want to go back to an article. I know it's about a week old that you wrote, but this goes back to what we were talking about before the break. And this has to do with testing, with COVID testing, and how that is impacting decisions that superintendents and trustees make. Can you talk a little bit about more about this? Because we have less data on testing now than we did in the summer?
Yeah, exactly. And it was one of those things that I just noticed as I was doing my day-to-day tracking of the coronavirus numbers. Back in July and in August, when we saw the state's case numbers really skyrocket, we also did see a large increase in test results. That didn't completely account for the increase in cases. I want to make that very clear. But we were seeing more testing. We were seeing about 20,000 or so tests coming in weekly. Still not where the state wants to be. The state needs to be about 37,000 tests at least, and ramping up even from there. But at least the numbers were moving in the right direction. More tests were coming in. More data was coming in. The past couple of weeks, those numbers have declined fairly significantly. They were down below 10,000 for a one-week period a couple of weeks ago, and that's what got me interested in doing the story. It's tracking at maybe about 12,000 test results per week. This has been a challenge for the state. It's been a challenge across the country to try to get enough testing data, but it does come at a time when the Middletons of the world, the Glens Ferries and the Emmets and the North Star Charters are having to make decisions about opening schools or closing schools. When Boise and West Ada are segueing into more face-to-face learning at a time when you would want to have more testing data and more information to base those decisions on. Like you say, we really are getting less testing data.
And then on top of all of this, Scott, we've talked quite a bit about this here on our program, and we talked about it earlier this week with our medical experts, but the critical importance of getting a flu shot this year. And I would think that especially if our testing isn't where it needs to be, but talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, and I got my flu shot yesterday, so I am all set. But health officials are worried about what's being called a twindemic of the flu virus and the coronavirus happening at the same time. So, you know, you think about it, our flu season spikes in October or December through April. And when people are inside, it's colder and immune systems are a little weaker. And if we don't have a vaccine for coronavirus, we're going to have likely spread of increased spread of coronavirus, because their flu virus and coronavirus are spread kind of the similar ways. And the two main reasons that health officials want to get people vaccinated for the flu is, number one, they want to reduce the burden on the healthcare system. And so, you know, the CDC said that there were about 490,000 hospitalizations due to flu-like illnesses in the United States last year. The year before that, it was 810,000. So the flu season really fluctuates greatly from year to year. And if we have a really bad flu season, that burden could be really strenuous on our healthcare system. And the other element of this is that there's a concern about co-infection. So if you get the flu virus and the coronavirus at the same time, I spoke with Dr. Brian Birch at St. Luke's, and he said that he used the analogy that if your friend punches you in the shoulder, it hurts. But then if he comes back and punches you again in that same spot, it really, really hurts. And so they're concerned, and they don't really have a lot of data on this, but they're really concerned that it'll be an exponential illness if you get both of them at the same time. So they're really hoping to get the numbers up. And Idaho has really low numbers for child flu vaccination rates. We are the fourth lowest child flu vaccination rate in the country at about 48%. So the state or the country as a whole has about 63% of children get vaccinated for the flu, and Idaho is at 48%, fourth lowest in the nation. So Idaho in particular is really hoping that we can ramp that up, especially if we want to get kids back in class and sports and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really important that we don't have a flu epidemic at the same time as the coronavirus this year.
Well, I already made my kids go get stuck with it. So I tell you, there was there. Me too. So, I mean, I didn't make them just do it themselves. So, Jimmy, what's going on with this ACLU lawsuit over Idaho's Crimes Against Nature statute?
Yeah, we're talking about a really old crime that goes back to Idaho's territorial days.
Okay.
So it outlaws sex with animals, which this lawsuit isn't challenging, but it also bans oral and anal sex between consenting adults. And so the anonymous man in this lawsuit was convicted in another state more than 20 years ago of performing oral sex on his wife, and he was released from an Idaho prison earlier this year on an unrelated charge and was told that he needed to register as a sex offender because of this past conviction. Right. And so that means that, you know, you can't live in certain places, you can't get certain jobs, and his information is available for the public to see on this registry. And so the U.S. Supreme Court actually found that these types of laws were unconstitutional in 2003, which is what the ACLU of Idaho is basing its case on. And it should be said that really starting in the 1950s, these types of laws were used against the LGBTQ community, right, which was the situation with this 2003 Supreme Court case. And you had former Justice Anthony Kennedy blasting these laws. He wrote that they advance, quote, no legitimate state interest which can justify its intrusion into the individual's personal and private life. You know, I reached out to the Idaho Attorney General's office. They don't comment on pending litigation. So we're just having to wait to see for its response in court documents.
Wow. That is...
It's a lot.
It's a lot. But it's shocking in a lot of ways that he was convicted of that. I think that there's an assumption that yes, these old laws are on the books, but you wouldn't be convicted of anything. So Scott, I want to talk about the fact that we are about 5.5 weeks away from the November 3rd election. And there are people who still have not received their absentee ballots. And I think getting a bit nervous about that.
Right. Because the usual deadline for mailing out absentee ballots was September 18th. And that got changed during the extraordinary session to give county clerks a little more time to prepare the ballots because they're going to have a lot more ballots to mail out. When I checked last Friday, there were 325,000 requests for absentee ballots in Idaho, and about 125,000 of those were in Ada County. So Ada County Clerk Phil McGrain is already at 125,000 absentee ballots that he has to mail out. So the deadline has changed. And of course, we have a lot of first-time requesters who have never requested before, and we've been getting questions about, well, when am I supposed to get my ballot? So the deadline got moved back to October 5th. Now, there are some counties that are already mailing out their ballots, that they're pretty confident that there aren't going to be any changes. There are some deadlines in this time period, a deadline to withdraw your name from a nonpartisan race. So, for example, if somebody in the CWI, College of Western Idaho, trustee race wanted to withdraw their name, they could still do that. And so county clerks may want to wait to print their ballots, especially if they have to print 125,000 of them. They want to wait until that deadline has passed and they're sure that they won't have to change those ballots before they mail them out. So Ada County Clerk Phil McGrain told me that, you know, don't panic just yet. People in outlying counties are already starting to see their ballots in the mail, and some will probably see some of their ballots this week. And by October 5th is the deadline. So that week of October 5th, people should definitely be getting their ballots. And if they don't get it by October 12th, then they should panic. That's when they should panic, is that week of October 12th, and check in with your county clerk to make sure that you got it. You could always check the status of your ballot at idahovotes.gov. Hmm. You plug in your name and date of birth, and it'll tell you what the status of your ballot is.
That's good information, Scott. Kevin, when you were, I believe the last time you were on the roundtable, we talked about enrollment numbers for higher ed institutions, and we really were having to wait. We kind of had a little bit of information, but you've gathered more. So what are those numbers looking like?
Well, the higher ed numbers, I don't think we're going to have a really clear picture on the final numbers until October. But what we're seeing at this point, both with the public schools and the private institutions, is we're not seeing that cratering in enrollment that the institutions were fearing. You know, back in the spring, when colleges and universities went online, the concern was that enrollment would drop significantly, 10%, 15%, 20%. That hasn't happened in Idaho. The numbers that we're seeing are kind of a little bit all over the place. Idaho State University is expecting a drop off of about 3%. I think University of Idaho is at about a 4% drop off. Boise State is expecting a slight increase, but it's an interesting increase, and I'll really want to see the numbers when they're final. It's a slight increase driven largely by an increase in students coming from out of state, wanting a face-to-face learning opportunity. So they're coming from states where that's not available, coming to Idaho, paying the out-of-state tuition to come to a state where they can do face-to-face learning. And that's a big deal for Boise State. Any kind of enrollment increase, even if it's a modest increase, is going to offset some of those financial realities that Boise State is facing that are necessitating talk of cutting programs or cutting operations and cutting employees and cutting positions.
So then, Kevin, what about federal help financially for higher education? Is that a potential option?
Yes and no. I did a piece about this on Thursday, trying to break down a little bit of where the colleges and universities have put federal coronavirus aid. All told, the public universities and colleges got about $49 million from that CARES Act. Now, some of that went directly to students. It was designed to be direct student aid to cover things like childcare or travel or lost earnings because work study jobs dried up. So it was direct student aid. The rest of it was institutional aid, and it's kind of covering, in a lot of cases, it's covering PPE. It's covering plexiglass for classrooms or thermal scanners. It's covering, in a lot of cases, is really covering technology to try to make it easier to offer classes online, to offer hybrid learning. And that will have some long-term implications because you'll have the equipment to use beyond hopefully the end of the pandemic. But it really does not help the universities with the financial challenges that they're facing, the underlying shortfalls that have affected U of I and ISU, and the kind of the pending revenue crunch at Boise State that's unfolding right now. We talked about football and the return of football. That's a big driver. The revenue that Boise State stands to lose with no football season was about a $25 to $30 million hit in lost revenue. And this federal aid does nothing to replace lost revenue. You know, the institutions are on their own. So the federal aid does help, and it helps cover the university's expenses related to coronavirus, but it really doesn't address all of the financial challenges.
Okay. And then, Jimmy, what's going on in Washington County with some potential ordinances, but the Attorney General's office has already said these would potentially be unconstitutional?
Yeah, so Washington County held a public hearing on these three ordinances earlier this week. Like you mentioned, State Attorney General's office issued an opinion saying it's highly likely that these are unconstitutional, would not stand up in court. And what they would do is basically take away power from the federal government when it comes to managing roads, prescribed burning, mining and logging on these public federal lands, and give that power to the county commissioners. The majority of people who testified this week were supportive of the proposals. They said that they feel like the feds don't listen to them when it comes to land management issues, but there were a sizable number of people who were against it too, including several ranchers who hold federal land permits. You know, they agree with the goals of the ordinances. They would like some more, say in how these lands are managed, but that it shouldn't be done for so few people who it would apply to, like them, and they don't want taxpayers to, subsidize the legal costs to defend this. Mm-hmm. Which the AG's opinion also said that, it's going to cost a lot of money if this goes to court, especially how far they might fight it, through appeals and such. But commissioners are voting on these ordinances Monday morning, so we'll see if they choose to put them into effect.
Yeah. And then, Scott, Boise Mayor Lauren McClain held her first State of the City address recently, and I have to be perfectly honest. I think, we're living in such strange times right now that it kind of slipped my mind, because in past with former Mayor Dave Beter, this was a big deal, right? I mean, it was like a little mini celebration at the Egyptian Theater, the whole thing. And A, you can't do that this year, but B, I mean, this is like her first State of the City address in what we live in right now.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate because it is historic,
Yeah.
She's the first elected female mayor of the state of the city of Boise. And so it's historic, and it's kind of a shame that there wasn't more to do about it. It was held virtually online. But, and her State of the City speech was not very eventful. There wasn't any big announcement. There wasn't any surprise news to come out of it. She talked about the pandemic, and she talked about climate change. She addressed Black Lives Matter. She talked about her economic recovery team. She highlighted Valor Point, the veterans housing that is built out on State Street, and highlighted that. But no big announcements or policy initiatives. It was mostly positive, upbeat, aspirational. It was very short. It was only a half hour long, which I think for people who are sick of Zoom meetings, they're zoomed out. Right. I think they welcomed. And even though she did not mention her, the people who are trying to recall her or the people who have tried to recall her, I think she made a little bit of a hint at them when she said, "I intend to fight like hell with each of you, Boise." And so I think, if you read between the lines on that, I think she was making a subtle nod to those folks.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your Fridays to talk with us and to get us updated, because Scott, that's one of the great things about the roundtable, right? If you miss something, you guys are going to tell us about it. So I appreciate it with the State of the City. We've been talking with Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. Thanks, everybody. Have a good weekend.
You too, Gemma. Thanks.
Peace out, Gemma.
Go Mariners.
Peace out, Kevin. Up next, we're going to take you to Film Fort. More Idaho Matters next.